So we are on chapter 12. By the way, we decided to reread it again, but it was not so sure. So as I can remember, we decided to reread chapter 12, The Divine Work, on page 264. But because also there was not Radhika was not present, and we said perhaps it could be a good idea to read it again. But it was not mandatory. We can also continue, and I have the appendix to part one, and it's my new edition. So should we reread it or go ahead?
I would like to read this chapter, Divine Work, because I'm currently thinking about this principle of work. Like it is, I'm really, really thinking in my mind, how do you approach work? So it seems very relevant to me, but I mean, if you guys want to reread or feel about it.
Oh, we're good to
Yeah.
reread it, I think. Yeah.
Okay.
Couldn't
You
hear
read
you, Jen.
it? Yeah. It's very in line with what you are living now. So I think it's worth reading it again. So the order that I see, which is also not mandatory, but that's what I see, is Radhika, me, Andrea, John Robert, and Jeffrey, Jay. Yeah? Radhika, me. Oh no, now they have changed again, but okay. I said Radhika, me, Andrea, John Robert, and Jeffrey J. Okay? So Radhika, you have the honor to begin.
So it is page 64, right?
264, yeah, in the new edition, yeah.
Chapter 12, The Divine Work. One question remains for the seeker upon the way of.
Radhika, we'll have a few moments of silence before we read.
Okay, but am I on the right page? I just wanted to check because my file, my on downloaded copy has a different page number, I think. So it is.
You're correct, though. You're in the right place.
Okay, thanks. So, okay. Okay, shall I begin? One question remains for the seeker upon the way of works, when his quest is or seems to have come to its natural end, whether any work or what work is left for the soul after liberation and to what purpose. Equality has been seated in the nature or governs the whole nature. there has been achieved a radical deliverance from the ego idea, from the pervading ego sense, from all feelings and impulsions of the ego and its self-will and desires. The entire self-consecration has been made not only in thought and heart, but in all the complexities of the being. A complete purity or transcendence of the three gunas has been harmoniously established. The soul has seen the master of its works and lives in his presence, or is consciously contained in his being, or is unified with him, or feels him in the heart or above and obeys his dictates. It has known its true being and cast away the veil of the ignorance. What work then remains for the worker in man? And with what motive? To what end? In what spirit will it be done?
There is one answer with which we are very familiar in India. No work at all remains, for the rest is quiescence. When the soul can live in the eternal presence of the Supreme, or when it is unified with the Absolute, the object of our existence in the world, if it can be said to have an object, at once ceases. Man, released from the curse of self-division and the curse of ignorance, is released too from that other affliction, the curse of works. All action would then be a derogation from the supreme state and a return into the ignorance. This attitude towards life is supported by an idea founded on the error of the vital nature, to which action is dictated only by one or all of three inferior motives, necessity, restless instinct, and impulse or desire. This attitude towards life is supported by an idea founded on the error of the vital nature, to which action is dictated only by one or all of the three inferior motives, necessity, restless instinct, and impulse or desire. The instinct or impulse, quiescent, desire extinguished, what place is there for works? Some mechanical necessity might remain, but no other, and even that would cease forever with the fall of the body. But after all, even so, while life remains, action is unavoidable. Mere thinking, or in the absence of thought, mere living, is itself an act and a cause of many effects. All existence in the world is work, force, potency, and has a dynamic effect in the whole by its mere presence. Even the inertia of the clod, even the silence of the immobile Buddha on the verge of nirvana. There is the question only of the manner of the action, the instruments that are used or that act of themselves, and the spirit and knowledge of the worker. For in reality, no man works, but nature works through him for the self-expression of a power within that proceeds from the infinite. To know that and live in the presence and in the being of the master of nature, free from desire and the illusion of personal impulsion, is the one thing needful. That, and not the bodily cessation of action, is the true release. For the bondage of works at once ceases. A man might sit still and motionless forever and yet be as much bound to the ignorance as the animal or the insect. But if he can make this greater consciousness dynamic within him, then all the work of all the worlds could pass through him, and yet he would remain at rest, absolute, in calm and peace, free from all bondage. Action in the world is given us first as a means for our self-development and self-fulfillment. But even if we reached a last possible divine self-completeness, it would still remain as a means for the fulfillment of the divine intention in the world, and of a larger universal self, of which each being is a portion that has come down with it from the transcendence.
In a certain sense, when his yoga has reached a certain culmination, works cease for a man, for he has no further personal necessity of works, no sense of works being done by him. But there is no need to flee from action or to take refuge in a blissful inertia. For now, he acts as the divine existence acts, without any binding necessity and without any compelling ignorance. Even in doing works, he does not work at all. He undertakes no personal initiative. It is a divine Shakti that works in him through his nature. His action develops through the spontaneity of a supreme force by which his instruments are possessed, of which he is a part, with whose will his will is identical, and his power is her power. The spirit within him contains, supports, and watches this action. It presides over it in knowledge, but is not glued or clamped to the work by attachment or need, is not bound by desire of its fruit, is not enslaved to any movement or impulse.
It is a common error to suppose that action is impossible or at least meaningless without desire. If desire ceases, we are told, action must also cease, But for this, like other two simply comprehensive generalizations, is more attractive to the cutting and defining mind than true. The major part of the work done in the universe is accomplished without any interference of desire. It proceeds by the calm necessity and spontaneous law of nature. Even man constantly does work of various kinds by a spontaneous impulse, intuition, instinct, or acts in obedience to a natural law, and law of forces without either mental planning or the urge of a conscious vital volition or emotional desire. Often enough, his act is contrary to his intention or his desire. It proceeds out of him in subjection to a need or compulsion, in submission to an impulse, in obedience to a force in him that pushes for self-expression, or in conscious pursuance of a higher principle. Desire is an additional lure to which nature has given a great part in the life of animated beings, in order to produce a certain kind of rajasic action necessary for her intermediate ends. But it is not her sole or even her chief engine. It has its great use while it endures. It helps us to rise out of inertia. It contradicts many tamasic forces which would otherwise inhibit action. But the seeker who has advanced far on the way of works has passed beyond this intermediate stage in which desire is a helpful engine. Its push is no longer indispensable for his action, but is rather a terrible hindrance and source of stumbling, inefficiency, and failure. Others are obliged to obey a personal choice or motive, but he has to learn to act with an impersonal or a universal mind, or as a part or an instrument of an infinite person. A calm indifference, a joyful impartiality, or a blissful response to a divine force, whatever its dictate, is the condition of his doing any effective work or undertaking any worthwhile action. Not desire, not attachment must drive him, but a will that stirs in a divine peace, a knowledge that moves from the transcendent light, a glad impulse that is a force from the supreme Ananda.
So just one thing that struck me. So in the middle of this passage, Sri Aurobindo says, even man constantly does work of various kinds by a spontaneous impulse, intuition, instinct, or acts in obedience to a natural necessity and law of forces without either mental planning or the urge of a conscious, vital volition or emotional desire. Now, is that good or is that not good? Like when you are obeying an impulse within you, is that, I mean, is Sri Aurobindo saying that that is the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do? Because he says that is not desire.
He's just making an observation. It's an observation of how we function in our normal consciousness.
Also, this is not
even man constantly does. We constantly do things without really making a big decision, and we just do. It's not a suggestion. It's an observation of the ordinary mind.
So this would be your swabhava, like your rajasic or tamasic swabhava, or even sattvic.
Whatever, your regular functioning, not being an instrument, a conscious, willing instrument of the divine, which the rest of the text is referring to.
Yeah. The last sentence, he says that a will that stirs in a divine peace should be worked. Okay.
So when I read this, I thought, the being that they're describing is so far from any state I expect to achieve. I'm not sure why I'm reading this. But so then, Radhika, you came in and you said, oh, well, this is directly applicable to me. And I'm going, wow, this is not the same. We have read different things in this passage.
But I do feel that it's speaking to me because, you know, my constant experience. So if I'm not working, I actually get depressed. I need to constantly go, keep working all the time. And this passage is literally like that rajasic engine in me, doesn't accept it if I don't work. But then my way of working is not often harmonious. And this passage says that, right? It says that not desire, not attachment must drive him, but a will that stirs in a divine peace. So I do hear you, Jeffrey Jen, because I've also thought about it. So there is that impulse within me that drives me, but then Sri Aurobindo says that there is a transcendent will that can drive you. He says that it exists. So a transcendent will exists that can replace your personal will.
Yeah. This is why it is so important to become quiet, to be silent. So you can wait for the impulse to come rather than you doing. If you start to rest in being and you wait for the impulse and it always comes.
Yeah, I mean, that's words to me because I am like that energizer bunny. I have to keep If I stop, it's I understand at one point Sri Aurobindo says that in India, the classical solution is to stop working. And I understand that. I actually really identify with that because I have seen people the holy people in traditional ashrams. I've seen them and I can feel that they are different from me and I look up to them because they have achieved something that in my energizer bunny way, I cannot achieve. So that actually, it makes sense to me. Like if you ask me, what is the logical solution for, curbing your rajasic impulse, I would say it is to do what Shankara said and not work and, follow inaction. So what Sri Aurobindo is saying to me, it's actually very un-Indian. Like he says that, or to me, it seems extremely un-Indian. He says that it is that he says that you should make your consciousness dynamic and that you should allow the divine shakti to work through you. I mean, if you go to any of the classical ashrams, this is not what they do.
So Sri Aurobindo says that his yoga starts where the others end.
Yeah, I believe him because, you know, I look up to Sri Aurobindo, but my own mind is telling me that the only logical solution is inaction, because, you know, to put yourself in touch with the transcendent is, I mean, it is so far away from your natural experience that maybe one out of a million can do it. I mean, it's a possibility, but I mean, I don't know. Like I said, I read this and I believe this because I admire him, but I don't know if it is practicable. Like in practical life, who can do it?
But it is an aspiration, right? It's not, I mean, it's here because even though it's not directly accessible the way it's written here, we do have this aspiration to achieve something like the state. And it involves letting go of things rather than, you know, obviously because of the detachment issue. So he's describing something that is, I don't know, it's the being that I have trouble with, this sort of being who's done it all and moved beyond it. I mean, this is not any experience that I have, but the letting go and the aspiration to a state where you do the work because it comes into you, that I think speaks to us. So, yeah.
How is this different from an artist's creative inspiration? I mean, do they also not, is it the same thing?
No, I would say not. Also, the artist can have a rajasic way of working. There can be a much ego for showing others, look what great
but there is a, there is a, then. There is a waiting for inspiration that artists have.
Yeah.
And that
but
is
it's not
very
necessary. Different. Yeah. But not necessarily. I mean, there are artists who I would say are not yogic at all. But you can use, of course, yoga for making arts. That's for sure. Yeah.
Also there's also there's also a sense of being worked upon when one is doing, like, you know, when I'm writing, it's like, it's not always, doesn't always feel like it's me doing the writing. Sometimes it's something else that's writing through me, right? So you have that experience in art as well. They're like glimpses of something else, I guess.
Very frequently, musicians say that they don't know why and at what moment they wrote or that they made their best piece of art. It just came, and sometimes it comes when they expect it to the least. And in other moments, they try to find the inspiration and nothing comes. So it means that there are two different internal states with which we can open or close us. No? So
they also don't have to be conscious of the divine or even have that that aspiration to do the divine work. Because the divine works through us regardless of what we are aware of.
Can I keep going? In an advanced stage of the yoga, it is indifferent to the seeker in the sense of any personal preference, what action he shall do or not do, even whether he shall act or not. It is not decided by his personal choice or pleasure. Always he is moved to do whatever is in consonance with the truth or whatever the divine demands through his nature. A false conclusion is sometimes drawn from this, that the spiritual man, accepting the position in which fate or God or his past karma has placed him, content to work in the field and cadre of the family, clan, caste, nation, occupation, which are his by birth and circumstance, will not, or even perhaps ought not, to make any movement to exceed them or to pursue any great mundane end, since he has really no work to do, since he has only to use works, no matter what works, as long as he is in the body in order to arrive at liberation, or having arrived, only to obey the supreme will and do whatever it dictates, the actual field given him is sufficient for the purpose. Once free, he has only to continue working in the sphere assigned to him by fate and circumstances till the great hour arrives when he can at last disappear into the infinite. To insist on any particular end or to work for some great mundane object is to fall into the illusion of works. It is to entertain the error that terrestrial life has an intelligible intention and contains objects worthy of pursuit. The great theory of illusion, which is a practical denial of the divine in the world, even when in idea it acknowledges the presence, is once more before us. But the divine is here in the world, not only in status, but in dynamis, not only as a spiritual self and presence, but as power, force, energy. And therefore, a divine work in the world is possible.
There is no narrow principle, no field of cabined action that can be imposed on the Karma Yogin.
You skipped a reader there, Marco.
Oh, I think it was me. Yeah.
It was Radhika's turn, yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Okay, sorry.
There is no narrow principle, no field of cabined action that can be imposed on the Karma Yogin as his rule or his province. This much is true that every kind of works, whether small to man's imagination or great, petty in scope or wide, can be equally used in the progress towards liberation or for self-discipline. This much is also true that after liberation, a man may dwell in any sphere of life and in any kind of action and fulfill there his existence in the divine. According as he is moved by the spirit, he may remain in the sphere assigned to him by birth and circumstances, or break that framework and go forth to an untrammeled action, which shall be the fitting body of his greatened consciousness and higher knowledge. To the outward eyes of men, the inner liberation may make no apparent difference in his outward acts, or on the contrary, the freedom and infinity within may translate itself into an outward dynamic working so large and new that all regards are drawn by this novel force. If such be the intention of the Supreme within him, the liberated soul may be content with a subtle and limited action within the old human surroundings, which will in no way seek to change their outward appearance. But it may too be called to a work which will not only alter the forms and sphere of its own external life, but leaving nothing around it unchanged or unaffected, create a new world or a new order.
So I feel that this is actually describing what happened to Sri Aurobindo when he was in prison and he got the inner prompting to go to Pondicherry, and that his work was greater in the world than just the liberation of India, that he came for a higher purpose. So it feels very much as describing how Sri Aurobindo himself was directed to a great work, which we are still benefiting from.
Yeah, but like the more I read the synthesis, I am actually more and more drawn to the conclusion that like the theory of Maya, you know, the theory of illusion, actually is very logical and is the practical solution. Like the more I read Sri Aurobindo, it's like, oh, this is all so idealistic and romantic, but in practical life, actually the Vedantins were right. So, I mean, I understand. So this passage, right, he says that, you know, that there is no restraint placed on the liberated spirit. You can either like do the normal kind of work in your normal surroundings, or you can go and try to change the world. It sounds really romantic to me. But yeah, Sri Aurobindo, he exemplified, I mean, his work was large. I mean, his...
Yes, he lived this.
He did live this, but who else did? Who else did? That's what I keep coming back to. Who else did? Maybe like some of his disciples followed him, but...
We don't need to worry about that. We just do the best we can to follow this direction if we wish. Right?
Yeah, it seems very, very ambitious, actually. And as I said, like the more I read the synthesis, the more I find my, you know, the theory of Maya, like, I feel like, yeah, they actually were right. I don't know. It just keeps coming back to me all the time. Although Sri Aurobindo is actually fighting against that, right? He keeps saying that this is the traditional solution, but it's not the only one.
But I don't
yes, he says
he
it's the denial. He actually just said it is the denial of the divine in the creation. As if the divine is not here. So this doesn't matter. So we'll just stop. It's the exact opposite of what he is teaching. The immanent divine is central in this yoga.
Yeah. Yeah, he said practically that this is only a half realization. You only realize a static divine, but there is also a dynamic divine. And if you don't realize a dynamic divine, you fall into this inertia. Or if you have realized the static soul, self, which is in a sort of beatitude, completely silent, He doesn't say that it is wrong. It is a good realization. He only says, don't stop there. Go also beyond that. He also had the realization of Nirvana and all those things. And he doesn't regret it. He doesn't say that it is something wrong that we should reject. What he rejects is this idea that then it's all done. And then there is nothing else to do. Whereas he says, no, you have to go beyond that, and the divine must become also active in the world, not only in you, but also outside of you, through you. It's not easy, of course, but nevertheless, I think we don't need to realize all of this, especially not all at once, but here and there, practicing, sometimes one feels that something comes through. It's not the whole thing that he's writing here. But there are moments in which we feel that we are moving and doing our things harmoniously. And there are other moments where we feel this that we are, it's all friction. So it's not so entirely distant from our everyday experience, I think, especially for those who try to practice yoga.
Well, I think it may begin with getting inspired by Sri Aurobindo's vision, and then comes our aspiration. Then I get the longing to participate in that work, and that is my aspiration, and then that guides me through the, you know, at least through the initial phase of this work.
Sorry, I do kind of feel that. Whether or not I attain to these things that he's describing, if I'm doing the work that I think the world needs to have happen in order for us to progress, then I think I'm doing something along this road, even if I'm not getting it all, you know. And I'm not sure about the harm. I mean, I understand the sort of ideal of a harmonious way of doing things. But I have found sometimes that, for instance, in my writing, I have found sometimes that when I struggle with the writing and everything, every step forward seems to be a problem, sometimes that's my best work. Sometimes what comes out of it is extraordinary, not out of the harmonious, free-flowing stuff that just comes on its own, but the stuff that I struggle with is often where the strength comes from. I don't know what that says about but there is a kind of acceptance. Maybe it comes from an acceptance rather than an ideal of harmony. You know, it comes from an acceptance. And then something comes from that acceptance. I don't know. I'm just talking
about it. When you say struggle with the writing, do you mean that you're creatively blocked and you don't see, like, I mean, is it a creative block, like an intellectual block? Why do you call it a struggle?
Well, I kind of feel all writing is a struggle, but it's a struggle because one has to stay focused on what's doing and one mind goes off in other directions. And it's a struggle to find the discipline to do the work. Anyway, it's a complicated thing to describe, but
yeah, I can relate to this. I can relate to this because I have this similar experience. I don't know if it's the same thing, but in my case, at least, this is due to the fact that I have this inspiration. I have the idea that comes through almost immediately, and that comes through harmoniously. It's already there, almost instantaneously. But then there's this second step where when I must write things and put it into words, then the mind comes in and mentalizes this, and necessarily so. I'm not speaking of you, Geoffrey. I'm just taking up what you are saying and relating to my experience, which might be completely different than you. I don't know, or maybe not. And there is this inspiration, this harmony that comes at a certain level, or at a certain heart here, and then when I have to put it into words, there comes the friction. But the idea as in itself, this inspiration, this harmony of seeing things related to each other, is also now, in this moment, I'm trying to express something in words, which is self-evident for me, but when I have to put it into words, it seems a complicated thing, and there comes the friction with the words, I think, also. Should we proceed? Yeah, okay. It was my turn this time, I think. A prevalent idea would persuade us that the sole aim of liberation is to secure for the individual soul freedom from physical rebirth in the unstable life of the universe. If this freedom is once assured, there is no further work for it in life, here or elsewhere, or only that which the continuous existence of the body demands, or the unfulfilled effects of past lives necessitate. This little, rapidly exhausted or consumed by the fire of yoga, which is with the departure of the released soul from the body. The aim of escape from rebirth, now long fixed in the Indian mentality as the highest object of the soul, has replaced the enjoyment of a heaven beyond fixed in the mentality of the devote by many religions and their divine lure. Indian religion also upheld that earlier and lower call. Indian religion also upheld that earlier and lower call, when the gross external interpretation of the Vedic hymns was the dominant creed, And the dualists in later India also have kept this, that as part of their supreme spiritual motive. I don't understand the structure of the sentence. Indian religion also upheld that earlier and lower call. When the gross external interpretation of the Vedic...
The earlier and lower call, I think, refers to ceasing physical rebirth.
It's not the enjoyment of a heaven beyond, because...
Yeah. Yeah, together. It's the getting out of here as the ideal.
I mean, should not... The article... the article is missing the... Early, that the earlier and lower call was so and so.
Okay. Upheld that earlier and lower call.
Yeah, that earlier. It's good English. It's just
okay. I don't understand it, but we'll go through it.
They all upheld that. The emphasis is on that earlier and lower call. When?
That. Which is what exactly? Which was the earlier call? The
getting out of here.
Okay, so
getting free again. Free of rebirth.
Well, I interpreted that as the, because at some point Sri Aurobindo talks about the fact, it might not be in this one, it might be in Secret of the Veda, that this idea that the Vedic hymns were interpreted as being done by a primitive people and not any representative of higher. And so I think when he talks about that earlier and lower call, he may be referring to that, but
so to the hymns, to the hymns. Yeah, I think yes. Yeah, do you mean the hymns, the Vedic hymns? I would say
the gross and external interpretation of the Vedic hymns.
Yeah,
this idea that they weren't. Anyway, I'm just saying, but I may be wrong, but that's the way I read it.
Because dualists in India, dualists are they're usually the Vaishnavas, and they don't follow the Shankara creed of liberation. You know, as I mean, I don't know, I may be wrong, but they are the ones that they are theists, and I don't think their ultimate aim is liberation. So that's why I'm also confused, because dualists would not want escape from rebirth. I don't think so. So I also don't know exactly how to interpret that sentence.
Okay, doesn't matter. It's just the same. Indian religion also upheld that earlier and lower call when the gross external interpretation of the Vedic hymns was a dominant creed. And the dualists in later India also have kept that as part of their supreme spiritual motive. Yes, I think it's the aim of escape from rebirth, I think. Undoubtedly, a release from the limitations of the mind and body into an eternal peace, rest, silence of the spirit makes a higher appeal than the offer of a heaven of mental joys or eternized physical pleasures. But this too, after all, is a lure. Its insistence on the mind's world weariness, the life being shrinking from the adventure of birth, strikes a chord of weakness and cannot be the supreme motive. The desire of personal salvation, however high its form, is an outcome of ego. It rests on the idea of our individuality and its desire for its personal good or welfare, its longing for a release from suffering or its cry for the extinction of the trouble of becoming, and makes that the supreme aim of our existence. To rise beyond the desire of personal salvation is necessary for the complete rejection of this basis of ego. If we seek the divine, it should be for the sake of the divine and for nothing else, because that is the supreme call of our being, the deepest truths of the spirit. The pursuit of liberation, of the soul's freedom, of the realization of our true and highest self, of union with the divine, is justified only because it is the highest law of our nature, because it is the attraction of that which is lower in us to that which is highest, because it is the divine will in us. That is its sufficient justification and its one truest reason. All other motives are excrescences, minor or incidental truths, or useful lures which the soul must abandon the moment their utility has passed and the state of oneness with the Supreme and with all beings has become our normal consciousness and the bliss of that state our spiritual atmosphere.
Often we see this desire of personal salvation overcome by another attraction, which also belongs to the higher turn of our nature, and which indicates the essential character of the action the liberated soul must pursue. It is that which is implied in the great legend of the Amitabha Buddha, who turned away when his spirit was on the threshold of nirvana and took the vow never to cross it while a single being remained in the sorrow and the ignorance. It is that which underlies the sublime verse of the Bhagavata Purana, "I desire not the supreme state with all its eight cities, nor the cessation of rebirth. May I assume the sorrow of all creatures who suffer and enter into them so that they may be made free from grief." It is that which inspires a remarkable passage in the letter of Swami Vivekananda. "I have lost all wish for my salvation," wrote the great Vedantin. "May I be born again and again and suffer thousands of miseries so that I may worship the only God that exists, the only God I believe in, the sum total of all souls. And above all, my God the wicked, my God the miserable, my God the poor of all races, of all species, is the special object of my worship. He who is the high and low, the saint and the sinner, the god and the worm, him worship, the visible, the knowable, the real, the omnipresent. Break all other idols. In whom there is neither past life nor future birth, nor death nor going nor coming, in whom we always have been and always be one. Him worship. Break all other idols."
It's an extraordinary passage.
The last two sentences contain indeed the whole gist of the matter. The true salvation, or the true freedom from the chain of rebirth, is not the rejection of terrestrial life or the individual's escape by a spiritual self-annihilation. Even as the true renunciation is not the mere physical abandonment of family and society, it is the inner identification with the divine in whom there is no limitation of past life and future birth, but instead the eternal existence of the unborn soul. He who is free inwardly, even doing actions, does nothing at all, says the Gita, for it is nature that works in him under the control of the Lord of nature. Equally, even if he assumes 100 times the body, he is free from any chain of birth or mechanical wheel of existence, since he lives in the unborn and undying spirit, and not in the life of the body. Therefore, attachment to the escape from rebirth is one of the idols which whoever keeps, the sadhaka of the integral yoga, must break and cast away from him. For his yoga is not limited to the realization of the transcendent beyond all world by the individual soul. It embraces also the realization of the universal, the sum total of all souls, and cannot therefore be confined to the movement of a personal salvation and escape. Even in his transcendence of cosmic limitations, He is still one with all in God. A divine work remains for him and the universe.
Comments before I read on?
Yeah, I feel like this passage contains so much. I mean, there's that place where he says, he who is free inwardly, even doing actions, does nothing at all, says the Gita, for it is nature that works in him under the control of the Lord of nature. So there's two things. He's talking about inward freedom, and then he's also talking about nature working in you, but under the control of the, I guess, the Purusha. I think this is what I struggled with. Like, what do you mean that nature works in you? I mean, it's true that when I work, when I do something, I always feel like an emotional attachment to the work. So then to be free means that you probably don't have that emotional investment or that emotional bond.
You would have the joy of doing the action, just for the joy of it, because it's the right thing to do, because you were guided.
But then when you judge, you know, what is right and what is wrong, you're going...
That's not part of this. The judging mind is a limited mind. If I follow how I am moved, there is no question about right or wrong, because it's not initiated by my ego. I allow it to flow through me.
Well, I mean, the classic counter argument would be Hitler was also moved by some wicked spirit that was not his personal ego, actually. Like, Mother herself says that there was this asura who took control of his mind and was giving him...
Well, his personal ego was a perfect instrument for that force. He was a deeply conflicted person.
Yeah, I think this idea of inward freedom, it's really strange, because, you know, I don't have that. So the conception of that is, to conceive that you can have that is...
You can aspire.
I don't have it.
You can aspire to it. You keep surrendering. To keep surrendering and keep aspiring, it will come. You're very young.
No, I'm not that young.
Yeah, it will come.
Yeah, but even that conception, I think, is... I'm happy that he says that it is possible to be free, at least in that way.
Vedantin would...
Marco, can you hear us?
You're frozen, Marco. We can't hear you.
We can't hear you.
Don't you? Can you hear me?
No.
Now we can, but we didn't hear anything for the last...
Okay.
We didn't hear... From when you started talking, we didn't hear it.
Okay. So probably it's not worth it. So someone up there decided to give it a cut.
Some angel of chaos, maybe not the angel of the divine, but
I speak too much, therefore it's probably more an angel, a divine angel than a fallen angel.
No, Marco, because you will then give me like a complex, because I also speak too much. No, I actually want to hear what you said. If you don't mind.
Yeah, it was just an analogy. I mean, that probably Sri Aurobindo don't know how much he would appreciate that, but it came to my mind that the Vedantin, the non-dual teachers, who say that they it's like sitting this inner liberation that is not attached to the outer world, but you are in the world. These non-dual teachers say that it's like sitting in a cinema. They see the world on a screen passing by, but they have no emotional and psychological attachment to it. Yeah. And in this sense, they perceive this inner liberation, moksha, as a great spiritual achievement, because you don't suffer for what. And it's like sitting in a cinema. You see the film of life going on and being liberated from it. Of course, Sri Aurobindo says, yeah, but again, that's again an intermediate passage, because that's nature that is displaying its film. But we must also bring down the divine nature, not so letting go the lower nature and just observe it.
They have a very different experience of cinema, because I go into the cinema and I'm all rolled up and engaged with the things. It's not some remote stuff that happens.
Depends what you're watching, I guess. But Marco, I wonder what the non-dualist would say, like, you know, in a situation where, like, you know, in the Gita, like, Krishna is talking to Arjuna and they were in a battlefield, like Arjuna not fighting, you know, like in that circumstance, you know, Arjuna's kinsmen were being attacked and Krishna tells him to counterattack. So are they saying that you watch the world go by, but at the same time you should participate in it, but participate in it in a way that preserves your freedom, that your freedom is not conditioned by what you do? But that's, it doesn't make sense to me though. The minute you act, you are
if
bound.
You only act on the divine impulse that comes when your ego is quiet, like Krishna urges Arjuna to do his will. He represents the divine, Krishna. And so to do the battle, because that is God's will. And then you just do that because you're still free inside. He doesn't, as long as he's not free inside, he doesn't want to fight his kinsmen. And that's not the right action at the time, according to the divine.
I understand this in an abstract way, but not practical way.
This reminds me of something that we read previously. I don't know where this was, where Sri Aurobindo says that we should take all our actions not as our actions, but the divine action. Just even if you're not at that level and so on, always recall that it's nature that is working through you, and everything that you do right is not your merit, it's the divine merit. And this is okay, this is a part which is not, which the ego doesn't like so much. But the good news is also when all your failures are the failures of the divine. And this is a part I like, because every time that something goes wrong, I can say it's not my fault, it's the divine. No? So, but if you take this seriously, try. Everything that you obtain and goes well, it's not your merit. But also everything that goes wrong is also not your fault. If you practice this with time, you will see that a certain sort of detachment appears, and where you feel a bit of this inner liberation that comes, that makes itself feel inwardly. It's also that because this is a video sessions called Synthesis of Yoda Practicum. Of course, we cannot practice all this stuff from one day to another. But I think there are a lot of points that are very instructive also for our everyday living. We should not, the only thing we should not believe that from today to tomorrow we will become supramental, but and also not in a week and also not in a month, perhaps not even in this life, but there are, if you interpret it to the life that we are living now every day, you can find the connection and it can become very useful, a practicum.
No, I think synthesis has some very practical advice. Not all, some of it is like really very abstract, but some of those passages when he talks about, you know, how desire is, how you conceive that desire is the only force that can impel your work. But then he says that, no, that doesn't have to be the case. You can be the engine driven by the transcendent. I mean, that if it is true, then that is a beautiful solution. Like I said, like maybe because I grew up in that environment, like my own mind tells me that Shankara was right, but Sri Aurobindo has a different message. His message is, like, I can see that it is very different from the traditional Indian solution.
Should I keep going or?
Yeah.
That work cannot be fixed by any mind-made rule or human standard. For his consciousness has moved away from human law and limits and passed into the divine liberty, away from government by the external and transient, into the self-rule of the inner and eternal. Away from the binding forms of the finite into the free self-determination of the infinite. Howsoever he lives and acts, says the Gita, he lives and acts in me. The rules which the intellect of men lays down cannot apply to the liberated soul. By the external criteria and tests which their mental associations and prejudgments do prescribe, such a one cannot be judged. He is outside the narrow jurisdiction of these fallible tribunals. It is immaterial whether he wears the garb of the ascetic or lives the full life of the householder, whether he spends his days in what men call holy works or in the many-sided activities of the world, whether he devotes himself to the direct leading of men to the light like Buddha, Christ, or Sankara, or governs kingdoms like Janaka, or stands before men like Sri Krishna as a politician or a leader of armies, what he eats or drinks, what are his habits and his pursuits, whether he fails or succeeds, whether his work be one of construction or of destruction, whether he supports or restores an old order or labors to replace it by a new, whether his associates are those whom men delight to honor or those whom their sense of superior righteousness outcasts and reprobates, whether his life and deeds are approved by his contemporaries or he is condemned as a misleader of men and a fomenter of religious, moral, or social heresies. He is not governed by the judgments of men or the laws laid down by the ignorant. He obeys an inner voice and is moved by an unseen power. His real life is within, and this is its description, that he lives, moves, and acts in God, in the divine, in the infinite.
Radhika, it's your turn.
Yeah, sorry, I just was looking for the unmute. But if his action is governed by no external rule, one rule it will observe that is not external. It will be dictated by no personal desire or aim, but will be a part of a conscious and eventually a well-ordered, because self-ordered, divine working in the world. The Gita declares that the action of the liberated man must be directed not by desire, but towards the keeping together of the world, its government, guidance, impulsion, maintenance in the path appointed to it. This injunction has been interpreted in the sense that the world being an illusion in which most men must be kept, since they are unfit for liberation, he must so act outwardly as to cherish in them an attachment to their customary works laid down for them by the social law. If so, it would be a poor and petty rule, and every noble heart would reject it to follow rather the divine vow of Amitabha Buddha, the sublime prayer of the Bhagavata, the passionate aspiration of Vivekananda. But if we accept rather the view that the world is a divinely guided movement of nature, emerging in man towards God, and that this is the work in which the Lord of the Gita declares that he is ever occupied, although he himself has nothing ungained that he has yet to win, then a deep and true sense will appear for this great injunction. So actually, I'm kind of lost. What is the injunction? The Gita declares that the action of the liberated man must be directed not by desire, but towards the keeping together of the world, its government, guidance, impulsion, maintenance in the path appointed to it. So that is the injunction. And he says that to participate in that divine work, to live for God in the world, will be the rule of the Karma Yogin. To live for God in the world, and therefore so to act that the divine may more and more manifest himself and the world go forward by whatever way of its obscure pilgrimage and move nearer to the divine ideal.
How we shall do this, in what particular way, can be decided by no general rule. It must develop or define itself from within. The decision lies between God and our self. This is the supreme self and the individual self that is the instrument of the work. Even before liberation, it is from the inner self, as soon as we become conscious of it, that there arises the sanction, the spiritually determined choice. It is altogether from within that must come the knowledge of the work that has to be done. There is no particular work, no law or form or outwardly fixed or invariable way of works which can be said to be that of the liberated being. The phrase used in the Gita to express this work that has to be done has indeed been interpreted in the sense that we must do our duty without regard to the fruit. But this is a conception born of European culture, which is ethical rather than spiritual, and external rather than inwardly profound in its concepts. No such general thing as duty exists. We have only duties, often in conflict with each other, and these are determined by our environment, our social relations, our external status in life. They are of great value in training the immature moral nature and setting up a standard which discourages the action of selfish desire. It has already been said that so long as the seeker has no inner light, he must govern himself by the best light he has. And duty, a principle, a cause are among the standards he may temporarily erect and observe. But for all that, duties are external things, not stuff of the soul, and cannot be the ultimate standard of action in this path. It is the duty of the soldier to fight when called upon, even to fire upon his own kith and kin. But such a standard or any akin to it cannot be imposed on the liberated man. On the other hand, to love or have compassion, to obey the highest truths of our being, to follow the command of the divine, are not duties. These things are law of the nature as it rises towards the divine, an outflowing of action from a soul state, a high reality of the spirit. The action of the liberated doer of works must be even such an outflowing from the soul. It must come to him or out of him as a natural result of his spiritual union with the divine, and not be formed by an edifying construction of the mental thought and will, the practical reason, or the social sense. In the ordinary life, a personal, social, or traditional constructed rule, standard, or ideal is a guide. Once the spiritual journey has begun, this must be replaced by an inner and outer rule or way of living necessary for our self-discipline, liberation, and perfection, a way of living proper to the path we follow, or enjoined by the spiritual guide and master, the guru, or else dictated by a guide within us. But in the last state of the soul's infinity and freedom, all outward standards are replaced or laid aside, and there is left only spontaneous and integral obedience to the divine, with whom we are in union, and an action spontaneously fulfilling the integral spiritual truths of our being and nature. So this is the last section. No, there's still one section left. Comments, questions, or should we continue or finish the chapter?
I'm okay to go till the end of the chapter.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, okay.
You have time? Everybody has time? It is this deeper sense in which we must accept the dictum of the Gita, that action determined and governed by the nature must be our law of works. It is not, certainly, the superficial temperament or the character or habitual impulses that are meant, but in the literal sense of the Sanskrit word, our own being, our essential nature, the divine stuff of our souls. Whatever springs from this root or flows from these sources is profound, essential, right. The rest, opinions, impulses, habits, desires, may be merely surface formation or casual vagaries of the being or impositions from outside. They shift and change, but this remains constant. It is not the executive forms taken by nature in us that are ourselves, or the abidingly constant and expressive shape of ourselves. It is the spiritual being in us, and this includes the soul becoming of it that persists through time in the universe.
We cannot, however, easily distinguish this true inner law of our being. It is kept screened from us so long as the heart and intellect remain unpurified from egoism. Till then, we follow superficial and impermanent ideas, impulses, desires, suggestions, and impositions of all kinds from our environment or work out formations of our temporary mental, vital, physical personality, that passing experimental and structural self, which has been made for us by an interaction between our being and the pressure of a lower cosmic nature. In proportion as we are purified, the true being within declares itself more clearly. Our will is less entangled in suggestions from outside or shut up in our own superficial mental constructions. Egoism renounced, the nature purified, action will come from the soul's dictates, from the depths or the heights of the spirit, or it will be openly governed by the Lord, who is all the time sealed secretly within our hearts. The supreme and final word of the Gita for the yogin is that he should leave all conventional formulas of belief and action, all fixed and external rules of conduct, all constructions of the outward or surface nature, dharmas, and take refuge in the divine alone. Free from desire and attachment, one with all beings, living in the infinite truth and purity, and acting out of the profoundest deeps of his inner consciousness, governed by his immortal, divine, and highest self, all his works will be directed by the power within, through that essential spirit and nature in us, which, knowing, warring, working, loving, serving, is always divine, towards the fulfillment of God in the world, an expression of the eternal in time.
A divine action arising spontaneously, freely, infallibly from the light and force of our spiritual self in union with the divine is the last state of this integral yoga of works. The truest reason why we must seek liberation is not to be delivered individually from the sorrow of the world, though that deliverance too will be given to us, but that we may be one with the divine, the supreme, the eternal. The truest reason why we must seek perfection, a supreme status, purity, knowledge, strength, love, capacity, is not that personally we may enjoy the divine nature or be even as the gods, though that enjoyment too will be ours, but because this liberation and perfection are the divine will in us, the truest, the highest truth of ourself in nature, the always intended goal of a progressive manifestation in the universe. The divine nature, free and perfect and blissful, must be manifested in the individual in order that it may be manifested in the world. Even in the ignorance, the individual lives really, no, even in the ignorance, the individual lives really in the universal and for the universal purpose. For in the very act of pursuing the purposes and desires of his ego, he is forced by nature to contribute his egoistic action to her work and purpose in the world. But it is without conscious intention, imperfectly done, and his contribution is to her half-evolved, half-conscient, her imperfect and crude movement. To escape from ego and be united with the divine is at once the liberation and the consummation of his individuality. So liberated, purified, perfected, the individual, the divine soul, lives consciously and entirely, as was from the first intended, in and for the cosmic and transcendent divine and for his will in the universe.
In the way of knowledge, we may arrive at a point where we can leap out of personality and universe, escape from all thought and will and works and all way of nature, and absorbed and taken up into eternity, plunge into the transcendence. That, though not obligatory on the God-knower, may be the soul's decision, the turn pursued by the self within us. In the way of devotion, we may reach through an intensity of adoration and joy, union with the Supreme All-Beloved, and remain eternally in the ecstasy of his presence, absorbed in him alone, intimately in one world of bliss with him. That then may be our being's impulsion, its spiritual choice. But in the way of works, another prospect opens. For traveling on that path, we can enter into liberation and perfection by becoming of one law and power of nature with the eternal. We are identified with him in our will and dynamic self as much as in our spiritual status. A divine way of works is the natural outcome of this union. A divine living in a spiritual freedom, the body of its self-expression. In the integral yoga, these three lines of approach give up their exclusions, meet and coalesce or spring out of each other. Liberated from the mind's veil over the self, we live in the transcendence, enter by the adoration of the heart into the oneness of a supreme love and bliss. And all our forces of being uplifted into the one force, our will and work surrendered into the one will and power, assume the dynamic perfection of the divine nature. That was a very intense chapter, I must say. Very, very intense chapter.
Yeah, you can see why we wanted to kind of reread it just to
Yeah, very heavy. And it's not like super abstract. It's not that abstract. He's actually telling you, like, I mean, these must be things that he lived. For him, it was actual reality, I guess.
That's why he's able to write about it. Because he knows.
Yeah, because that's what I'm constantly struck by. Like, he doesn't write like other philosophers in very abstract language. Like, the language itself is like, this is how it is in practice. It's a very, I mean, if you've read philosophers like Kant or even like modern philosophers, I think Geoffrey Jen must have read a lot of philosophers, right? You mentioned that you had, but most philosophers.
I think Marco has probably read more than I have, actually. But
okay.
Not much. I have read about them. That's not the same thing as reading their original texts. But yeah, yeah. But I understand what you mean. Yeah, it's certainly not a philosopher, a classical, typical. Certainly not a Western philosopher, which are very abstract, and sometimes one has the impression that they play with words, not with, and don't relate it to a real experience. Yeah.
Go ahead, Andrea.
No, I actually don't see Sri Aurobindo as a philosopher, but as a seer,
yeah,
who realized this consciousness in himself, and he's transmitting to us. He's telling us how it is from his point of awareness, which is so vast. I haven't seen anyone supersede Sri Aurobindo so far.
He also said this once. He said, I never ever had the intention to be a philosopher. Now I'm rephrasing with my words. Mm-hmm. When people say that he is a philosopher, said nope.
Yeah, he's not.
I don't see where did I? Mm-hmm. What he is writing is the direct. Yeah, he uses a philosophical language, perhaps, but he describes an experience. It is not a philosophical theory that might be wrong or right. He says that's what I have seen. It's different.
It's why we called this reading group a practicum, right? The idea was to focus on how it applies to our lives.
This is his 150th birth anniversary year. Did you know that?
15th of August, yes. Yeah, it's coming, yeah. So, intense also this time, I would say.
I just realized when you said that his 150th birthday is coming up, that I arrived in Pondicherry in 1972, which was his centenary.
Oh!
So I've been in this for 50 years.
50 years. That's an achievement, Andrea.
Yes, was I came, I got there, and then I saw, I heard, I understood as much as I understood, and that's what I wanted. Couldn't think of anything better to do with my life than working for the divine manifestation on the planet in myself as much as I that is possible for me. Yeah.
I wish I had that constancy. I go about.
You I wonder. Have another 50 years at minimum.
But
I'm
a life
pretty sure
its,
about that.
A life has its seasons, and you come and go through them. So
yeah.
It's too early for you, Radhika, to say that it's not constant. It's it can be maintained even if it comes and goes. Is what I'm getting at.
I don't know. I get what you mean. I do feel in Sri Aurobindo's case, I feel like he's different. Like, I don't know how to describe it, but he is so different from any other. Like, there are many spiritual figures in India, and some of them have millions of followers. I mean, there is Sadhguru, who is very popular right now. Ravish,
there's nobody. Yeah, there's nobody like him.
No one.
Except for Mother. You know, Mother and Sri Aurobindo were on the same page. They were in the same consciousness.
Yeah, and it's sad also that there is no one else like them, even now in the ashram. Like, I... Yeah, I don't know. There's no one else like them, which is good and bad. Like, bad because we need them, but...
We have them. We have them.
We have their writings.
That's why all of this is given to us. Yeah.
I suspect that if they would still be here, we would fall into inertia and say, let's go to Sri Aurobindo and Mother and ask them, put the question, ask a question, and give the, and they give you the answer. It's not too easy. We have
discover I had an interesting. Yeah, I had an interesting experience when Mother left her body. I was in Oroville. And when the news was brought to us by a French person on a bicycle, I had it was a shocking news, but I had the immediate realization, inner experience, that now I didn't have to write letters to her anymore because she would be inside of me. There's now a direct, she's not bound anymore by that body. She is now omnipresent, like Sri Aurobindo, like we all are in some level, but they, with their level of consciousness, they're really there. Yeah.
Should we make 2 minutes meditation?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, we should.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Till next time.
See you.
Bye-bye.